yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber bands straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. The show is Alternative Visions. Okay, in previous weeks, we have been alternating these shows, talking about the global economy and different sectors of the global economy. You know, if you look globally, there are about five major sectors that are important and how they interact as to the future of the direction of the global economic crisis, which continues morphing and changing form into what I call now, at the beginning of 2014, the third phase of this crisis. Okay, and we've been talking about China on March 1st of this show, talking about the slowing of Chinese growth and the growing of financial instability, shadow banks, so forth, in China, a prediction that was made 9 months ago. And then before that, on February 26, we talked about Japan and its Abenomics, Abe being the prime minister there, the new policies named after him. Which I predicted would come to a halt last year, and of course the economy has pretty much, the stimulus has come to a halt there. Of course, stock market did very well because it was very much a Federal Reserve type monetary central bank stimulate the banks and investors and they'll put their money in stock markets and send it abroad kind of recovery. Pretty much an echo of the United States after 2009. And on February 19th, we talked about the bigger picture, emerging markets and the perfect storm. Okay, what was that? Well, three things to watch. One was the emerging markets are in trouble, growing volatility and instability as money flows back, currencies collapse, money flows back to the West, currencies collapse, capital flight. And as they, these emerging markets, particularly the Fragile Five being India, Indonesia, South Africa, Turkey, and Brazil, try to stem the capital outflow and the currency decline by raising their domestic interest rates, which then slow their economy. And as I predicted, this would be an on-off-again kind of a process, which is happening. The second element of the perfect storm, of course, is China and its slowing economy, heading for a hard landing, and growing financial instability as it desperately tries to rein in the shadow banks that are destabilizing its local and property markets. And then the third element of the perfect storm I talked about was the Eurozone and how it is drifting towards deflation. In other words, falling prices. Right now, prices are disinflating. In other words, growing slower and slower, and we're almost at a zero price growth in the real economy throughout the Eurozone, and about to head into deflation. Deflation being very dangerous because when prices fall, consumers stop their purchases or slow their purchases, waiting for prices to fall even further. And businesses don't invest and expand and create jobs because they're not sure if the products they're going to sell as they come on market are going to be at a price less than the cost to produce them. So business freezes up, consumers freeze up, deflation is very dangerous. And Eurozone is heading for it. In fact, in some countries, it's already in deflation. All right, so the perfect storm, where's the convergence of these three ideas and developments, emerging markets, fragile five, particularly China slowing, Eurozone drifting towards deflation. And then on April 12th, I talked about the USA economy in relationship to the rest of the global economy, the major sectors. Globally, of course, being North America, one, Eurozone, EU, Europe, two, emerging markets, three, China, and Japan. Okay, those were the major sectors. If you want to know what's going on globally and how the global developments will impact any one of these five major sectors, you have to look at them in relationship to each other, because it's a global capitalist economy today, and of course it's been a global financial system for some time now, several decades. So one does not affect the other without the other affecting the one. Okay, so today we're going to turn back to this analysis, and having given an overview of China, Japan, emerging markets, and the USA, the fifth area now I'm going to look at, and that's the Eurozone. And then in future weeks, you know, we've been alternating between economic global economic analysis and the labor movement in the U.S. and why it's at a strategic impasse. We will come back to that. Once again, summarizing in subsequent weeks here, summarizing the effects of the discussions we've been having with longtime trade unionists on are American unions at a strategic impasse? Okay, but let's turn back to the economy today, okay, with a survey. We want to focus our attention on the Eurozone, first and foremost. This is 17 countries in Europe that share the common currency called the euro. That's the heart of the European economy. And then, of course, there's the larger European economy, the European Union, which includes Scandinavian countries and the UK and so forth, that have still their own currencies. So we want to look at both the euro economy and the European Union. I'll have a few things to say about Britain's so-called recovery, UK's so-called recovery. And within the Eurozone, drilling down even deeper, we want to look at the periphery economies, the southern tier in particular, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Cyprus, Italy, but also Ireland and some of the Baltic countries, etc., Netherlands. Well, Netherlands is really not part of the periphery. So we want to look at those layers, because just as the five sectors globally interact with each other, importantly within Europe, the analysis must also look at the sectors, the southern periphery or periphery Eurozone, and the northern Eurozone, at the heart of which is the France, Netherlands, Germany nexus there. And what's the interactions between the north and the periphery here? Important to understand. And what's important is first quarter results for the Eurozone, very interesting. We have a significant real economic weakening going on in the Eurozone, in particular in France and in Netherlands and in Scandinavian countries, Finland and so forth, aren't really part of the Eurozone, but they're connected in terms of the slowdown. Okay. So, let's look at this stagnation, return to stagnation, after only a 12-month very, very weak recovery that began in the summer of last year, and not even a full year, and the Eurozone is slinking back again. Very weak recovery. Okay. And that, by the way, includes France, Netherlands, and in Germany, even, which is the engine of the Eurozone economy and has been growing slightly and enough to keep the Eurozone barely above stagnation and probably even in a recession again. The growth seems to be mostly all in Germany, and that's not very much, and that is also appearing to slow. Okay. So, Let's talk about that. Why, first of all, is the Eurozone and Europe important? Well, it's the second largest global economy sector in the world. You know, the U.S. has a GDP about $17 trillion now. China's GDP is about $10 trillion. It could be more depending on how you want to calculate it. There's been lately an interesting debate going on if you calculate it according to PPP, purchasing power parity prices, China's almost as big as the U.S. But let's just hold the regular estimate of about $10 trillion, so second largest. But the EU-EZ economy is somewhere between the U.S., just slightly less than the U.S., and more than China. So obviously these three sectors are extremely important, and then you could say, well, Japan, you know, at about $6 trillion is also important, and emerging markets are fifth important. Okay. So another reason why the Eurozone, not just measured in terms of GDP, which I have some real criticisms of, particularly since GDP, real GDP, is determined by what's called the nominal growth of investment spending and spending, consumers, households, businesses, government, adjusted for inflation. And almost everywhere, the adjustment for inflation is inadequate. In other words, inflation should be reducing GDP to get to a real GDP more than it is. And if that were so, we would have had deeper and more frequent recessions than we have. In other words, for example, in the U.S., GDP in the first quarter of 2011 came to an actual halt. Right? Small decline in GDP. If we had properly estimated inflation, it would have been a very clear GDP decline first quarter 2011. Same thing happened in the fourth quarter 2012. The economy came to a halt. And if we had properly measured inflation, it would have been a negative GDP. You know, from the very beginning, I've been saying that 2009, since then, the recovery would be stop-go, and quite possible that we would have a double and triple dip recessions bouncing along the bottom. Well, in the U.S., these one-quarter collapses are what I call a relapse, not a recession. But they would have been recessions if we had properly estimated inflation. So we really have had a double dip and possibly even a triple dip if we had properly adjusted for inflation, not the conservative adjustment that's used, which is bouncing along the bottom. So, okay, so it's a relapse, no growth for a quarter rather than a recession for two quarters. The point is U.S. growth has been way below historic par after 5 years, and no end in sight to any real sustained, vibrant recovery in the U.S. Well, the same thing's been happening in Europe and in Japan since 2009 as well. Europe has had a bona fide, even conservative, price adjustment, recession, a double dip, we'll talk about in 2011 to early 13. And Japan has had a triple dip. Everybody's bouncing along the bottom, you might say, exception being China, for reasons we pointed out last, well, in that March 1st show we had on China. Go back to that in the archives if you want to listen to that, and go back to the February 19th if you want to listen to the View on Emerging Markets show. Okay, so why, after this digression, why is the Eurozone and Europe important? Not only because of the size of the GDP, but the Eurozone EU population is larger than the U.S. Okay, it's also the second largest banking financial system and source of global money capital in the world. It's a major source of global exports and imports. And the Euro, the Eurozone, 17 countries' currencies among the top three, maybe four, well, definitely top three global currencies, the other being the British pound and now rising the China yuan. Okay. Like the U.S., Europe, the Eurozone, experienced a deep financial crash in 2007-8, early 9, okay, almost the same kind of a crash, right? But whereas the U.S. recovery, as weak as it has been, began in the mid-2009, right, with the GDP averaging in the U.S. Less than 2% annually, annual rate for the next 5 years, right? The European Eurozone recovery was far worse than the U.S. recovery. As poor as the U.S. recovery has been, Europe has been worse. And the question is why. In 2007-9, the economy dropped in GDP terms more than 5%. No, it was contraction right along with the U.S., showing the close integration, particularly of the financial systems of Europe and North America, and particularly the U.K. and the U.S. You know, it's almost the same economies now financially, U.K., U.S. Europe's Eurozone here, the continent, Eurozone's post-2009 recovery was shorter and shallower. In other words, after the decline, when the U.S. recovery started, Europe's lasted only 18 months and then went into a second double-depth recession in 2011. Right. That double-dip lasted about 18 months. Okay. And now it's come out of the double-dip. Here, as I said, the second quarter of last year, but the recovery is even weaker than the first recovery in 2010-11. In 2010-11, the Eurozone GDP grew only roughly one half of 1%. That's hardly any growth. The U.S. was growing maybe 1.5 to 2%. Well, Eurozone first recovery after the crash was only 0.5%. Right? And then it fell into another recession, as I said, 2011-13, okay, which was a decline about 0.5% of GDP. Very shallow recession, right? Not a big crash like 2008-09, but nonetheless a recession in the Eurozone, pretty much wiping out any of the shallow gains of the previous 18 months of about 0.5%. Okay, so you even them out, it's essentially no growth after the crash. Okay, so last year, as I said, in second quarter 2013, we had a little bit of recovery in the Eurozone. But that was barely 0.2%. I mean, you could even argue that was no recovery. That is just all, you know, conservative price estimation adjustments to GDP. But let's say, okay, 0.2% annual growth rate for the last nine months. Okay, hardly any growth at all. Mm-hmm. During this long period since the crash in 2008, of course, the southern periphery of the Eurozone has been in a bona fide depression with unemployment, 20% plus. Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Cyprus, Ireland, the whole thing in the periphery. Really, really a depression. And now we're seeing even the northern part of the Eurozone slowing down and sliding back into recession, particularly France and the Netherlands. We'll talk about that shortly. So a bumping along the bottom recovery, pretty much, even closer to pure stagnation than in the U.S. After 5 years, the question is why the Eurozone in Europe is even worse off than the United States in terms of recovery, which isn't even historic average in the U.S. This is all part of what I had called an epic recession, where the recovery is mostly recovery for banks and large corporations, and the rest of the economy is left behind. The banks are bailed out, but the real economy is not bailed out, and we have a bumping along the bottom, a stop-go recovery, as I said in the show on a few weeks ago, on April 12th, when I talked about the U.S. economy. That is the characteristic of an epic recession. A financial bailout, but no real stimulus for the rest of the economy. The result is you don't fall back into a depression, but you have short, shallow recoveries followed by short, shallow relapses or shallow double dip recessions followed by short, shallow recoveries, so on and so forth. In my 2010 book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, I gave historical examples of this. The U.S. before World War I and at the beginning of the Great Depression in the 1930s, and, of course, Japan in the 1990s and so forth. There are precedents and examples of these kinds of stop-go recoveries. Okay, so Europe, Eurozone, a shorter, weaker recovery than the U.S., followed by a double dip and a still further weaker recovery last year. That shows signs of fading once more today, particularly in the first quarter results of this year, where countries like, for example, Netherlands actually dropped 1.3% GDP, and a host of other parts of Northern Europe were also negative GDP. Ireland, by the way, supposedly bailed out some time ago with the banks, dropped 2.3%, Portugal 0.7%, and so forth. So the recovery didn't last very long, and now it's hit the Eurozone again. And of course, in the U.S., we would blame that on bad weather, as we've done first quarter bad weather. Well, you know, Europe had exceptionally good weather this past winter. And it slowed down, whereas the U.S. supposedly had bad weather. I don't believe in weather metaphors. I think when economists start talking about weather as causes, you know, they means they don't have an answer, an explanation, and they're just picking up a metaphor and blaming Mother Nature for their bad policies and economic problems. All right. The Eurozone, okay, is drifting towards deflation. Now, deflation in the real economy, real goods and services, not financial assets. You know, financial asset bubbles and so forth aren't reflected in GDP or in prices of real goods and services. The asset bubbles are reflected in prices for financial assets, which aren't included in GDP. So when we say drifting towards deflation, we mean that there is a real economic slowdown in a real economy going on that slows down price growth, right, for goods and services. And that's happening in Europe, drifting towards deflation. The big problem, just as emerging markets, currency instability and capital flight and interest rate hikes are its problem, and just as we've talked about China, its problem, it's dealing with its shadow banks and its bubbles in local debt markets and housing markets and so forth, and general restructuring in China, that's all slowing down China. All these things are happening concurrently, and my point is they have an impact on each other and exacerbate each other in what this third phase of the global crisis is. The global crisis is not centered in the U.S. economy per se. U.S.-UK, U.K. is just an appendage of the U.S., follows the same policies, etc. Its interest rates almost mimic each other, bond rates, etc. So it's not centered in Anglo-American, where the crisis really erupted first in the first phase, right? Second phase, meaning the double-dip recessions in Japan and in the Eurozone, Whereas in the second phase, the emerging markets boomed, and China boomed in the second phase, which was up to last year. But the third phase is emerging since the middle of last year unevenly. There are periods of in different sectors where there's a slight recovery, you know, and but the long-term trend is the slight recoveries don't last long, and it turns around once again, as we're seeing in Europe, and begins to fade once again, right? So three key indicators to watch for what's going to happen in Europe, and that's the Europe real goods and services deflation, a signal of a real stagnation reappearing, recurring, maybe never really offset last year because the 0.2% GDP growth is so weak that it statistically may not have even happened, particularly if you adjust prices correctly. China's hard landing, right, as it deals with its problems over there, meaning hard landing, meaning a slowing to a GDP growth of around 6% or less. Well, that may sound high, but in China, which was growing, you know, 12, 14%, 6% or less, hardly absorbs the new entrants into the labor force, hardly keeps that economy above water. And China's exports are slowing long-term, very clearly, as the global economy slows. And as China tries to restructure from business, government, government infrastructure investment to more consumption, household consumption, spending as a basis for the economy, and less export-oriented economy in China. So it's going through its problems as Europe deflation occurs, and as emerging markets instability grow, and as the governments in those markets attempt to deal with currency collapse, capital flight by raising interest rates, which slow down its own domestic economy. Okay. What we're seeing in this third phase, and what's why it's important to Europe, is that reversal of massive money flows that went into the emerging markets in China after the 2008 crash. The U.S., U.K., and the Eurozone, central banks pumped up their money supply, pumped liquidity into the banks to keep them from collapsing, gave them free money, pretty much. In the U.S., 0.25% as a result of Fed policies. Banks could borrow, and, of course, quantitative easing, which is where the central bank actually prints money and goes out and buys the bad, previous bad bonds and investment made by the professional investors and banks, and pays them more than they were worth at the market price. So direct subsidy by printing money. In the U.S., that's about $14 trillion so far pumped into the banks. And, of course, it refloated the banks, except a couple of them that are still essentially technically bankrupt and have been in the U.S., and that's Bank of America and Citigroup, but they won't let those fall. And they cover up the real situation with their phony stress tests of the banks. The Fed does. Okay, so, but most of the banks, you know, are refloated this way. And but what do they do? Well, you know, it's supposed to, theoretically, according to mainstream economics, then take this money and loan it to businesses in the U.S. to create jobs that would raise income and stimulate consumption and get the recovery going. Well, they, but they don't do that. What they do with all this free money is to send it offshore. And this money flowing offshore significantly stimulated emerging markets in China after 2009. Well, that's why China has a shadow banking problem, because a lot of this has slipped into China, local property markets, through the shadow bank systems, unregulated bank system in the U.S., which is really the big banking system now, where the elite capitalists, finance capitalists, really rule, and causing those problems in China. But the point is, after 2009, all the governments of the West here, and the central banks pumped all this huge amount of money. I mean, it occurred in Bank of England, and now it's occurring Bank of Japan, to some extent also European Central Bank. A lot of it flowed offshore. It didn't go to stimulating domestic investment. Why? Because the bigger profits were offshore. And it flowed into banks started lending again to shadow banks and their investors who speculate in financial asset markets, you know, emerging markets, currency markets, derivatives, property around the world, foreign exchange, etc., right? And this is one of the big contradictions of global capitalism, 21st century. You have such a huge overlay of shadow banking and ultra-high net worth investors who are addicted to free money and to using that money and leverage and borrowing and investing in financial assets, liquid financial asset markets, because the profitability is so much greater in financial assets and the turnaround much quicker. And that's one reason why we see global real investment slowing everywhere. Capitalism is making more money from financial speculation around the world now than they are from real investments. That's not to say that there's no real investments, but the ratio and rate between the two is shifted. Right? So what we have is this massive capital flow, money capital flow, after 2008-09 into the emerging markets in China as a result of this monetary policy, central bank policy, over $20 trillion at least of money injections into QE and investors from the core Western banks and government central banks into the emerging markets. Well, that stimulated the growth into the emerging markets. The investment that was supposed to occur in the West did not. It occurred elsewhere, and it occurred in financial assets, or the banks just sat on a lot of the extra money. U.S. bank reserves are now over $1 trillion sitting on it, right? So this is the financial monetary contradiction that exists globally here. So China booms, emerging markets boom, U.S. has the subpar recovery because it can't get real investment jobs going. Europe has a double dip, Japan has a triple dip in this whole process here. Okay. Now, as I said, this is the first phase, the crash everywhere. The second phase, that's 2007-09, the second phase is this stop-go phase in the U.S. and double dip, triple dip, Japan, so forth, and boom in China emerging markets. Okay. The third phase now is the boom in China emerging markets is over. That's what's different. And we still have a stop-go in the U.S., and we still have an even more serious epic recession that's been afflicting the Eurozone in Europe. Sort of stagnation and non-stagnation instead of just stop-go in the U.S., both very, very weak. But now the only source of the real growth in a global economy, keeping things up for a while, was China and emerging markets, but now they are slowing as well. That's a major change. Major change. And, you know, when I say this slowing and so forth, step go, I'm talking about long run. I'm not talking about month to month or even quarter to quarter. You can't be misled by short term changes in indicators. You got to look at the longer term, multi year trends here. Okay, so the third phase begins in the summer of 2013. What happens in summer 2013? Well, we see a little pickup in the U.S. and the Eurozone economies. In other words, we see the short, shallow recovery coming back. After, you know, 2011 and 12, those two relapses in the U.S. and the second double dip in the Eurozone, and the third in Japan, we see the recovery, as, you know, subpar recovery occurring 2013 up until the beginning of this year. Why? That's because the money starts flowing back. All that huge money capital outflow that occurred in the second phase to the emerging markets in China is starting to come back to the West, to Europe, and to North America. Why is that? Because of the Federal Reserve and other central banks, Bank of England and so forth, shifting their policy, saying that, well, we're going to reduce QE, quantitative easing, which, of course, they did, and talks about plans to raise the interest rates in different ways going on in the U.S. and in the U.K. right now. The China stimulus also runs out of steam by 2013. That 2009 stimulus, which was 15% spending of GDP, U.S. spends 2009 only 5% of GDP. Well, that's why China really, one reason China recovered quickly and the U.S. did not after 2009. Okay. So their stimulus of 2009-10 runs out of steam in China, and China began simultaneously to move on its shadow banks to stop the property bubbles going on, and they raise interest rates in China, and that slows the economy even more. This is all last early summer, right? With the combination of the U.S. QE and Britain QE moves, reversing those moves, and China slowing, the emerging markets begin to crater. What that means is capital currencies begin to collapse in emerging markets. Capital starts flowing back because of the currency collapse. FDI, foreign direct investment, flows back out of the emerging markets to Europe and to the U.S. Emerging markets economies try to raise their interest rates to stem the currency decline and capital flow. We'll see, they've had a little positive effect in that regard, slowing down this long-run process, but not really stopping it. And that's the major factor here that's new. This money is flowing back to North America. Right? Because it's flowing back to North America, the central banks, Fed, Q, and Bank of England and ECB, feel there's not as much need to keep pumping additional money into the economy. That's why they're slowing down QE. That's why they're talking about raising rates, right? Because the money is coming back. This is a capitalist tactic. We bailed out our banks, our financial investors, by allowing them to speculate once again and push money offshore and so forth. Had a negative effect on our domestic economy, but now we're going to bring that money back, right? We're going to force that money back from emerging markets and elsewhere back into the core, the capitalist core, North America, Europe, Japan, and therefore we don't need to pump as much additional new in as we did before. In other words, we'll stimulate our economies once again, hopefully at the expense of the emerging markets economies. So what happens is the money comes back, and what's it doing to Europe, you might say, to the European economy as a result? Well, when the money comes back, what that means is that these foreign sources have to buy euros if they want to park their money in the Europe and UK and U.S. economy. In the U.S., they have to buy dollars, right? That increases the demand for that euro currency and British pounds, right? And drives up the exchange rate for euros, let's say. And, of course, higher exchange rate means that you're going to have a slowing exports out of Europe as a result. So that's one of the negative effects of this. We'll talk more about the negative effects. You may have heard recently about how Portugal had just followed Ireland, announcing its exit from the IMF, International Monetary Fund, borrowing. In other words, Portugal, like Ireland just before, it says, we don't need to borrow any more IMF money. course, they're all up to hock, and the IMF is still paying, but we don't need to borrow anymore. Well, some have been saying this is a sign of Europe recovery. No, it's not. What does it reflect? Well, it reflects that this money coming back is coming into Euro Southern Periphery government bonds. In other words, all the money flow coming back is buying these bonds in Spain, Portugal, and so forth, which means the Spain-Portugal government does not have to borrow from the IMF because foreigners and investors are now buying their bonds, and they're raising the money by selling government bonds to these foreign investors. By the way, it's not all just emerging market investors. It's U.S. investors and U.K. and Northern Europe investors that are now plowing into southern periphery bonds, Portugal bonds, Spain, so forth, right? Greek bonds. So what's happening in these countries is they're just exchanging one form of debt for the other. That's all. Instead of borrowing, adding more debt from the IMF and other European facilities, they're just selling their government debt, rolling the old debt over and selling it to these emerging these investors, right? So why would investors want to invest now in Portugal and Irish bonds and other bonds in the periphery? Well, because the spread between these bonds in these countries, which is around 5-6%, selling bonds at, is far greater than the 2.5% of U.S. 10-year bonds and the 1.2% of German bonds. So investors see a nice opportunity, short-term opportunity here, to make a 4-5% interest rate spread on these bonds. And that's what's happening, you see. It's not affecting the real economy. Real economy austerity is still continuing. Portugal GDP first quarter fell 0.7%. Ireland's GDP fell 2.3%. So the real economy is slowing here. Austerity policies are continuing here. Jobs aren't really being created. Income and consumption aren't really being created. But you got this recycling of bonds going on, which means investors, financial investors, speculators, are making good money out of the whole thing. But it's all because emerging markets are coming back into Europe in periphery bonds, and even in North America and UK and even Germany. Why are they doing this? Well, it's not just the spread. It's that opportunities for speculation and speculative super profits seem to be drying up globally. They're under pressure in China, speculating in property, right? There's less volatility between currencies in the world, so speculating in foreign exchange, which is just a manipulated market anywhere. Anyway, in the past week has been shown, banks have been manipulating foreign exchange markets just as they manipulate LIBOR and all the other interest rate markets and the gold market and everything. Banks are just crooks manipulating everything, everywhere. And it's been going on forever. So it's just coming to the surface here. I better not get off on that one. That's a whole show in and of itself. So investors are chasing yield, as they say, chasing yield. In other words, opportunities are drying up elsewhere, and they are addicted to these high yields as a result of all this QE and money injection for years now. And one of the places where there's still high yield is in these periphery bonds. Now, when these periphery countries were in deep economic trouble, and their bonds were, 10-15%, looked like they were going to default on them. Well, people don't want to plow into something that may default. But the bonds have come down to, 5-7%, and it's sort of a Goldilocks area there. Not too risky, and yet risky enough to go after high yield and get a good return, see? And that's why we see this bond churning going on in the Euro periphery here. It's the hottest play right now. Okay. But it's not stimulating the real economies at all in those countries. Okay, so money capital is returning, but it has negative economic effects because, raises the euro and reduces competitiveness and exports, which countries like Germany are extremely dependent upon. You know, it's a very highly export-dependent economy, and German exports, people don't realize, huge amount of German exports go to China, and significant exports between Germany and Russia, right? That's why all this Ukraine stuff is got the Germans all shook up here. They don't know what's going to happen and the impact on them. There's no impact on the U.S. The U.S. can, you know, talk about sanctions all they want, and it's very little effect, pro or con, on the U.S., i.e. U.S. sanctions on Russia and Russia's counter-sanctions on the U.S., but Europe, very, very serious. At a time when they're stagnating, now we're going to talk about sanctions on them, and Europeans that aren't happy with U.S. sanction demands. That's why they're not going to really happen and be serious. They'll talk it for public consumption, but they won't really go along with it. Europeans will not go along with U.S. sanctions, although you'll hear the opposite in the press, right? And, of course, the Ukraine situation is destabilizing even more, causing problems of business confidence. Then this recent Russian-China gas deal means that gas prices are probably going to rise to the Europeans as a result. And you got to understand, like Germany, a country like Germany that has just turned its back on nuclear power and doesn't want to return to coal, is very dependent on gas. But the gas problem, is going to rise in terms of cost and uncertainty for the Germans. So they don't like that either. Growing pressure on the Eurozone to do something to stimulate the economy, right? As a result of this, forget all this talk about exiting the IMF, it's not an indicator at all of any real change. Austerity still continues and will continue. And the economies will continue to slow down in the Eurozone as a result. Okay. All right, so moving on here, what's the Eurozone to do? Okay, what's the Eurozone to do here, given its dilemmas that it's facing? Globally, economically, right? Government debt is being refinanced as a result of reverse capital flows from emerging markets and chasing of yield by UK and US and even Northern Europe investors, right? By the way, chasing a yield means not just buying periphery government bonds at 6%. They're chasing European junk bonds now as well. European junk bonds, which were never much of a market in Europe, but now they're booming as well. Right? Junk bonds mean high risk corporate debt, corporate bonds, and because they're higher risk, companies that aren't in that good a shape, they pay a lot more interest to investors. So if you want to take risks, you know, you buy high-yield bonds, right? Big changes here at the beginning of 2014 in the Eurozone, right? China is also reinvesting in Europe as well. So we have not only emerging markets money flowing back, buying bonds, but China has, for political reasons and other reasons, is diversifying and targeting Europe. It, too, is buying periphery bonds, but it's also announced some big reinvestment projects in Germany and in the U.K., right? Not too long ago, a month or so ago, big delegation from China to Germany. Germany, by the way, I believe its biggest export partner is not the U.S. I believe it is it's China. I could be wrong on that, though. But a huge amount of trade going on between Germany and China, just as there's a significant amount of trade going on between Russia and Germany. We're talking about $100 billion plus a year or more between those two countries, two sets of countries. That, by the way, is why I think the U.S. is getting nervous about Germany and the Eurozone getting too close, too dependent economically on Russia and its gas and trade, as well as on China. And, you know, one of the reasons behind precipitating this crisis the U.S. has in Ukraine, I think, is to provoke Russia to invade the Ukraine, which would give U.S. even more control, sever the relationship, the growing relationships between Russia and Germany economically, and force Germany back into a dependency on the U.S., particularly on U.S. Exports of shale gas. That provides a double advantage to the U.S., by the way, because the U.S. right now has laws that say you can't export shale gas, but now if Germany and Europe really depend on it and they're cut off from Russia, then that will change quickly in the U.S., and the big energy companies in the U.S. can now export shale gas to Europe and reverse the glut of gas here in the U.S. and allow them to raise prices here in the U.S. So this is all global. The Ukraine thing is all about global economics, really, in the last analysis, in a whole number of ways. Listen to my previous shows. There's three of them on the Ukraine. Also, you can go to my my website and my blog, jackrasmus.com. My website, where I've been interviewed on several occasions here in recent months by Russia Radio, talking about the economy in the Ukraine and IMF deal there. In any event, what we got is China pumping money into Europe as well, and U.S. investors chasing corporate bonds yields, and even northern investors. Now, what about the U.K.? What can we say about the U.K.? In some ways, U.K. is has a nominal recovery, even better than Europe, but it's an artificial false recovery. It looks more, UK looks more like the periphery than Germany or France. Periphery of Europe, in my view here, right? How is that? Well, the only reason you got a recovery going on in the UK now is because of this massive inflow of capital coming into the City of London. That's the banking system, right? And policies by the Cameron administration, the Prime Minister there, Conservatives, Cameron, redirecting that money primarily into London real estate by certain incentives, both commercial and non-commercial real estate, and you got a real bubble going on in London and southern England here. Property values really at bubble levels. Combination coordination between the emerging markets and the Cameron. Cameron administration and China pumping money in as well into infrastructure, London infrastructure and London banks and so forth. Right? So a lot of money flowing in there causing a property bubble. If you look elsewhere in England, property prices are not rising in most places as much, and some places still even falling. It's a little bit like the housing recovery in the U.S., so-called, which is already stalled in the U.S. It will stall in Europe. In London as well, of course. If you look at what's happened in last year, we had a little bit of recovery in housing. Well, a lot of that was foreign money coming into the U.S. It was institutions like hedge funds buying up big blocks of unoccupied houses and so forth in certain markets, in those hot markets where the price appreciation potential was the greatest, you know, places like Arizona and California, etc. And that's already over. Prices have risen enough. They're dumping that stuff. They're pulling out. The investors are pulling out again, and the market has come to a crash here. Not a crash, but it's slowed down again. Well, something like that going on in the UK. Artificial property bubble, some foreign Chinese investment and so forth. a conscious strategy on the part of Cameron to repeat what George W. Bush and then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan did in the U.S. in 2002 and 2003. Looked like the economy was slowing again after a recession of 2001, so those two consciously designed a subsequent bubble in the economy, in the housing economy in the U.S., and of course that led to the housing crash in order for to get reelected in 2004. And so George could go into his war in Iraq in 2003. So they pumped up artificially the housing sector. You can do that quick. The government can do that quick. And that's what Cameron is doing before the elections over there. But if you look at the Eurozone and the UK, there's some real negatives going on, right? The capital inflow from emerging markets is slowing now. Moves taken by those emerging markets, Fragile Five, to raise interest rates to prevent capital outflow have had some effect, right? And we see a problem, though, lagging problem already with the euro. Went bumped up to $1.40 to the U.S. dollar. Now it's going down again as the economy slows in the eurozone. Right. We see in the Eurozone the slowdown is spreading to the north, northern core economies, France, Netherlands, Scandinavia, Finland, places like that, East Europe. Right. Business uncertainties rising as a result of what's the central bank going to do, what's going to happen in Ukraine, what's going to happen with the sanctions and so forth. All this is causing uncertainty and a slowing of investment by business in the Eurozone, particularly in Germany, right? China slowing means German exports are slowing, right? German-French exports to Russia are question mark now because of sanctions in the Ukraine situation. Emerging markets, Japan having undertaken its own policy to lower its currency is now cutting into European exports. So a lot of negatives there, and it's reflected in the economy and the stock market in the Eurozone as a result. Right? The property bubble in southern England, UK, will not last. It will bust, as it has everywhere. It will end badly, as it did with the U.S., but Cameron's betting that he can get past the election before that happens, right? And he's doing everything to assist the U.K. bank bailouts. You know, he is really the minister of the banking system in this sense. The property bubble is a way to design to boost bank profits at a time when they are having difficulty. You know, the banks will they do participate in all these property deals. Pretty much, Cameron has let the City of London, the financial system, engage in what might be called cowboy financial capitalism, do whatever they want. And all that's coming to the fore as well, right? He is doing everything he can to prevent European Union financial bank regulations affecting the UK, even to the point I'm sure he will pull out of the EU if he has to. Right? He's cutting deals with the Chinese, with U.S. bank participation in his big projects, and he's welcoming the Russian oligarchs to send more money into London. But there are other problems with Scotland, and now parties that are opposed to EU unification or participation that are emerging in the UK. So the picture long term is not all that great in the UK. What about Germany? Okay, capital inflows are slowing. Ukraine-Russia sanctions drift towards deflation. And most recently, last week, German IFO Business Sentiment Index indicating Germany is going to continue to slow down. Germany is the last to slip into this pattern, already occurring in Netherlands and France and so forth. So no real recovery. Long term is the picture in the Eurozone for all these reasons, global and domestic. And the U.S., of course, we're waiting to see if this weather metaphor for the first quarter is an aberration. For the second quarter here, there will be some recovery, but not that much, I predict. And bonds doing better all around the world, which is an indication that investors think that the global economy is going to continue to slow. Okay, so the U.S., questionable. Japan is now dead in the water after a short money injection experiment. Emerging markets are trying to keep their head above water. China is slowing. And the Eurozone will continue to deteriorate long term. Okay, that's the picture in the Eurozone, in the global economy. We will be back next week. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.